Are we going?
Into podcast.
Potter Who Cast.
Advertiser call.
Billis Major at your service.
Don't forget me.
Sarah, did you forget me?
Oh, let's go, that's class!
There is no such thing as...
Doctor Who, Series 5, Episode 1. The 11th Hour. With special guest, C.C. McLaughlin.
Houston starred as General Eric Ludendorff in the 2017 film Wonder Woman.
Mm-hmm. Donny Houston.
I saw that movie and I don't remember what that is.
He's the, like, villain of
He's
it.
A fake-out villain, right.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then it's like David Thewlis comes in and he's like, I'm the villain now. Oh. And it's like, hi, David Thewlis. And he's like, hi. Danny Houston.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Do 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 do.
Why were we talking about Danny Houston? You will never know.
Yeah, Danny Houston.
Because he's the next doctor. So.
Yeah. You know, I really think I might be. Yeah. New season.
It's a new season.
It's one of my favorite types of episodes. New doctor, new TARDIS, getting the whole like fancy, funny, floppy skeleton vibe. It's one of the ways I like to see the doctor the most.
Mm-hmm. And
new doctor, new TARDIS, new showrunner,
and new look,
new production facilities,
mm-hmm. And
new companion. New everything, honestly.
Yeah, and new format stuff for us too.
Well, new everything except for the same source material. I'm looking at the set, and I see right behind the director's chair is a copy of The Time Traveler's Wife, well thumbed through with many notes and underlines in it. And I'm opening the cover, and it says, you know, and SM is the owner.
Stephen Moffat in the 11th Hour set, you know. You know what? I could adapt to Time Traveler's Wife. I could be the great Time Traveler's Wife. And so he's going, you don't really think you might.
I really think you might. We're really picking off where we left off. A couple of new things for us. And
there is one thing that is the same, which is Murray Gold.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know. We'll get to it, but there is differences, I think, in the approach from here compared to like the last like 2 or 3, 4 years. The 11th Hour. This is going to be a new thing. So it was broadcast April 3rd, 2010. This is a new thing where I want to spice things up because the format was getting kind of stale. So it's a new game. Where I want you to guess what was number one at the US box office when this aired. So April 3rd, 2010, either of you can guess what was number one at the box office when the 11th Hour was on TV. And you got 3 hints. You got 3 hints.
Was it Wolverine X-Men Origins?
That was 2009.
Oh, so good.
2010.
Actually, wait a minute. Because I don't want to... Hang on.
Was it a Wolverine release? Did we actually get it wrong and then we actually got it right?
No, I gotta check something because there might be a link. Is it in this one or is it the next one? It might be the next one. I'm thinking of... I'll give you a clue. The sequel. There's a sequel to this that... stars someone we were just talking about.
Danny Houston.
Yeah, Danny Houston's in the sequel to this movie. And it's
interesting.
It's a remake, I guess. Directed by someone who's kind of known for being like, you know, if you really are in the, like, if you're stuck for someone and you need someone who's like, you know, going to just turn up and film something and leave.
Is it Clash of the Titans?
I was about to say Clash of the Titans.
It is Louis Leterrier's Clash of the Titans.
Yeah.
To say Clash of the Titans because either Clash or Wrath, I can't remember, was on the box office game on the day we're recording this episode. Mm-hmm. So I've been thinking a lot about that, about the Sam Worthington Sam Worthington box office era that just like happened and then disappeared. As soon as it happened, he was out.
Danny Houston plays Poseidon in both, but has more scenes in Wrath of the Titans, which is directed by Jonathan Liebsman, I believe. It is. Wow, I was right.
Good for him.
Woohoo! Good for him. This was directed by Adam Smith, who before this had worked on Skins and a miniseries called Little Dorrit. And after this, basically, he has two paths. One is that he directs this Michael Fassbender film called Trespass Against Us, which is as Brendan Gleeson as well. It's like it kind of came out a couple of years ago. But he becomes like the go-to guy for the Chemical Brothers music videos. So he just directs like a lot of the Chemical Brothers music videos, which good for him, I guess. I don't know. It's a living. I don't know. And written by Stefan Meffin? Stefan Meffash? I can't really...
Bravo Moffat.
Oh,
his name is Bravo Moffat.
Oh, I thought it was Steven.
I'm seeing Tav Semithit.
I'm seeing Taffin.
Chris Chibnall.
I'm seeing Danny Houston. I don't know. That's weird. This is a new thing because the gist sounds like it sounds perverted if I say it in a certain way. So it's now been rebranded as In a Sentence. And so this is the thing, In a Sentence. As I get on my spelling bee announcer voice. In a Sentence. Doctor Who crash lands in the garden of a young orphan-ish person named Amy. She's kind of an orphan. She's kind of not an orphan. She's got a crack in her wall. There's, in fact, a crack in space-time, which leads to a jail where an evil snake named Prisoner Zero is being held, but he escapes. And then Doctor goes to the future, and with the help of adult Amy, defeats Prisoner Zero, and they go off into space together, even though she's getting married in the morning. She's getting married in the morning. So
we got to start things off by saying we brought our wonderful guest here, Stacey, to talk about the most important part of this episode, which is that moment when the camera goes into the 11th Doctor's eyes and we get a preview of what Sherlock will be like, where they're like, we just read about this camera move. We can do it now. And it's like, this is cool, but also I can think of like 10 ways you could have done this that would have taken you 5 seconds. Like it is ultimately so extra and so unnecessary, and it kind of adds to the swagger of this episode. I hate to use that word, I'm sorry, but it is kind of like it is an episode that's kind of like, we know what we're doing, guys, don't worry, we're in total fucking control.
They're actually trying new things visually, which I think is a really great way to start off a new series. I should say, by the way, that my name is CC McLaughlin. The CC stands for custard cod. And one of the things that I rediscovered watching this episode again was those little visual flourishes. Like, as much as we associate that with like the Sherlock vision that Moffat would, make iconic, I appreciated all of the little super close-up shots. The very like Wes Anderson-y framing of all these like different dishes the Doctor's trying. I actually thought it was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Has anyone here had fish fingers or custard? I have not had it.
I have.
Surprisingly, because this is around the time when I became a Doctor Who fan and everyone was fucking going on and on and on about this fucking fish fingers and custard. Maybe I have had fish fingers and custard. I could not for the life of me tell you what that tastes like because I don't remember. I listened to the comment. Sorry, real quick. I listened to a commentary track, and they were talking about how it wasn't fish fingers and it wasn't custard. It was sponge fingers and cheese sauce, which sounds even more disgusting than fish fingers and custard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bad combo, but it's a very like thick, viscous custard. I totally see that being like, you know, yellow nacho sauce that you get from like the AMC.
Mm-hmm. I will say, though, I think maybe I gaslit myself into liking it, but when I had it when I was like a teenager, I was like, this is pretty nice. And I think it probably wasn't, but I was like, you know, I gotta pretend it's nice because it's from my favorite show. I don't want to let my favorite fictional character down because they'll want to kill me if I do. they'll come out of the TV and they'll be like, you don't like this? You don't like this meal I like? And they would have put my head into a bowl of custard like Freddy Krueger, and I would have drowned in custard.
No, wait, hang on. I know what I need fish fingers and custard.
It's really interesting how, like, off. I know this isn't the first one you recorded, but like how off the bat, like, comfortable and confident Smith is in the role, like from the get go. Like immediately, he's like, "This is perfect. Like this guy's on the ball. This guy is so locked into, like, you know, how he's going to play this role, how he's going to like navigate all this stuff. He's really great with in that scene and the scenes after. He's really good with like Yon Amy as well, with the kid actor. I think he's really like, you know, he meets her on her level. He's really good, I think. Yeah.
Do you know what the trick they did that I found out and I thought it's honestly genius and it makes me wonder why they don't do this every time? This was not the first episode they shot. Mm-hmm. The first episode they shot was Time of Angels.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
It's actually very smart. By the time they shot this, he had already shot 4 to 5 episodes. So he was much more like he kind of. It's less him playing a character, him playing the doctor, finding out what his new quirks are, and more he already knows what the quirks are, so he can slowly build them in. Although I will say, there's very little of Tennant in his performance here. Very, very little.
Yeah.
It is probably the starkest transition. I think it is something they don't do again, because from what I remember, you know, 12 acts a little bit like 11 at the start, and 13 acts a little bit like 11 at the start. But it does feel like it adds a certain self-assuredness to the episode, like we're talking about, where it allows them to go a bit wild with things like, let's have a giant eye ship in the sky. Let's have let's have that shot where it goes into the doctor's eyes. Let's have Academy Award winner Olivia Colman come in to do three scenes.
Although she did not win. Academy Award winner Olivia Colman come into your show. That's a great way to make a good first impression.
Yeah.
Big sharp teeth and some kind of awkward dialogue about here's what the arc's going to be for the next couple of episodes. It feels like a bold kind of
like, hello.
It's just a really like, confident thing of like, you know, we're going to get into this like straight away. There's going to be no like, you know, faffing about. Mm-hmm. They'll be like they immediately center the companion. They immediately give her like so much like, you know, time to just breathe as a character and like really build up the idea. I think it's a really interesting way of going about this kind of story, because like usually it's going to be like, you know, like something like Rose, like you get that through like Rose's point of view. I guess like with all of like the Russell companion things, it's always like, you know, companion is like the centerpiece and like it kind of branches out then to like, you know, Dr. B like on the periphery. Whereas here it's very much like a two-hander of like, you know, you get like the Amy stuff, but like the doctor's always like in the middle of everything. He's always like, you know, a present force. But then they play off each other so well, I think that like it does work rather than it being like, you know, a bit too kind of general or standard or whatever. Like I think it adds to that, like they're both like such like good actors together, I guess. I don't know.
another coup of casting is that the person who plays young Amy Pond is so good. She is essentially in it for 15 minutes of the episode. Mm-hmm.
And she's her cousin as well, so it's kind
of... Yeah, she's her real-life cousin, which adds to the physical resemblance, but it does not account for the part that really matters, which is that you kind of have an innate sense of who she is as a character, even though even though the companion itself is a 16 years later version of this character, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It feels like she's grown, but at the same time, it's like she's a whole different person. She mm-hmm. is still the kid we meet at the beginning, just grown up.
Yeah, you can see what is still like lingered with her from being abandoned by the doctor. I think Karen Gillan does a really good job of like delivering that like frustration and immediate wonder at like actually seeing the doctor return to her home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it also helps to bridge what is ostensibly the most obvious twist of all time, which is when he comes back to the present and Amy's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Who? Amy who? It's like, I think it's admirable that they try to pretend it's not. And it does build up to that really good moment where, why did you say 6 months? Why did you say 5 minutes? That's mm-hmm. a really fun moment. That being said... And no one, if you have been tricked
not
by that
one
twist,
person. Yeah.
Please contact us. We need to study you scientifically. Like, it is the most obvious. She's literally like, she's ginger. She looks the same, which happens when you cast your cousin. She looks the same. She's ginger. Mm-hmm. It's like, I admire them for trying, but also you didn't need to.
Mm-hmm. Also, shout out to her for being the Amy that Big Finish gets all the time for stuff. She kind of, I wouldn't say lucked out. She probably would want to fire her agent or just stop answering the phone calls from breaks. But like,
I mean, that's a really good gig. Good for her. I would love to be the person they get because Karen Gillan can do it.
She was also in a Christmas movie with Sylvester McCoy and Fraser Hines like 2 years ago, I think. So, you know. It's a good gig.
It's a good gig. It's like being that alien in the background of a Star Wars movie. Mm-hmm. You've just guaranteed you'll always be invited to 1,000 conventions, even though you had less than one line, and all you did was say. People will be like, "Can you tell us like what did George tell you when he told you to say Yuga Baga?" He said, "Can you say Yuga Baga?" Please.
you'll visit the second most populous city in every state in the United States, and you'll just leave each convention with a garbage bag full of $20 bills. Mm-hmm. Not too bad.
Mm. Again, good gig if we can get it. Yeah. Kind of like Danny Houston, only you're doing conventions and not like... I don't know if you've ever seen what Danny Houston's filmography is like at the moment. It's all just like... randomly.
I know him. See, here's the thing. I know Danny Houston, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm so sorry to our audience for this tangent in the most tangent podcast of all time. But the instant you started talking about Danny Houston, I was like, yeah, Danny Houston. But in my head, I'm like, where do I know him from, right? Like, I'm trying to actually fake where mm-hmm. I know him from, and I can't come up with a possible answer.
Let me read you a list of his credits that you might know. He's in Succession series. Is it series two?
Not that. I'm sorry. It's not that.
Succession
isn't impressive. That's nothing.
No, it's not that it's impressive. It's I knew him before he was in Succession.
He's in, he's most famous, I suppose, for being John Huston's son and also for looking like a living caricature of himself because those eyebrows are crazy. He's in The Aviator. He's in Birth. He's in Marie Antoinette, he's in The Number 23, which we've all seen. He's in Had to Lose Friends and Alien People. He was in what we talked about earlier on, which is X-Men.
He's in Hitchcock. That's where I know him from. Yes, I loved that movie when I was a kid. He's in that movie where Anthony Hopkins plays Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. I love that movie.
He plays Whitfield. He's like a fourth lead in that movie. I'm pretty sure that movie.
But that's where I know him. It's also where I know James Darcy from. When James Darcy showed up in Agent Carter, I was like, "That's Anthony Perkins from Hitchcock." Listen, I'm not a simple person. I can't claim to make sense, but sometimes these things happen to me.
You know who plays Ed Gein in Hitchcock? Because Ed Gein is like Hitchcock's famous, like a movie where Hitchcock has like imaginary therapy sessions with Ed Gein, like for like half the
plot. Really?
Yeah, it's really weird. He's played by Michael Wincott, which is a good casting, but like Ed Gein does not need to be like the secondary antagonist or protagonist of the Hitchcock biopic. Ralph Macchio also plays Joseph Stefano, and then it's really weird seeing Ralph Macchio in a real movie.
In a real movie. Jesus Christ. Listen, my God.
Okay. Look,
I know what you feel. I know what you feel. It's like when somebody said
Cobra Kai is fake. Okay. No one's going to admit that Cobra Kai has never been a real TV show. It's something they made up for advertising campaigns. Like,
I get what you mean. It's also the opposite feeling of what it felt like to watch Neil Patrick Harris in Doctor Who, where you're like, you have a career. Like, what are you doing? like there is no reason for you to be here because this is not a stepping stone from you. Like, can you blink twice if Russell T. Davis has dirt on you? Like, can you just blink twice, please? It's also the same feeling I got when I saw that Jinx Monsoon was a doctor who was like, again, you have a career. Like, why? No offense. I mean, this is the thing that Doctor Who fans like to do is shit on Doctor Who.
The Pandorica will open. Silence will fall.
And we're off.
Speaking of 11th Hour, I want to propose something that I think you guys might disagree, but I want to propose it. I just want to throw it out. I think this is the best First Doctor story. Not as in a story about the First Doctor, but I think this is the best story, first story of a Doctor. I honestly think altogether it is the best one, like with no competition. I love Rose. I love... I don't love Robot. That would be a lie. I also don't love Time and the Ronnie. But I feel like, what's the competition? It's this and Spearhead in Space, right?
Deep Breath is also pretty good, I think.
I don't think Deep Breath is a good first. Because I think the thing is about this one, which is so unique about it, and honestly, I was thinking about it, and the fact that it has... The reason why I say it's this and Spearhead in Space is because both this and Spearhead in Space are pulling the double duty of marking down like a separation point of saying, and now we start a new era, you know, things are going to be different from now on. And that is something only Spearhead in Space and 11th Hour have in common. Deep Breath, the meta narrative of Deep Breath is that they have to convince the audience to accept an older doctor. And so it's less about that episode is more about Clara's relationship to the doctor than the doctor himself. Whereas this one, because Amy's a new character, it sort of becomes about our relationship with the doctor. And also, like, if you're starting this for the first time, you know, you are placed in the role of Amy and you're like, am I supposed to just accept that the show is about a guy who comes out of a box and solves some crimes? Like, is that what the show is about? And in a way, yes, it is. That's what this episode is about. That's what the show is about.
I mean, yeah, but Deep Breath is also kind of about that in a way, because the whole crux of it is that, like, she can't trust this man who's changed his face, and she doesn't.
But the reason, I think the big difference to me, and CC, I want to hear what you think about this. The big difference for me is that Clara is a pre-existing character, right? So if you start watching Doctor Who on Series 8, and God bless you if you do, again, please... make yourself known so that we can scientifically study you. But if you start watching episode 8, there's so much that doesn't work if you don't know who Clara is, including the bit at the end where Matt Smith calls her and he's like, please, please do not stop watching the show. It is the same character.
Yeah.
Like that is not a thing. They don't do this in Series 5 because they don't need to. But also it's like, that doesn't work if you haven't seen Series 7. If you don't know who Clara is, if you haven't seen the previous episode. Sure, it also works as like a, hey, here's a new era starting, but it is much more in conversation with what came before as opposed to this episode, which is in conversation with the audience. Like, Amy is the most audience surrogate character that Doctor Who has had. Even more than Rose, because we as an audience follow her on a journey that we probably followed we probably had our version of that journey, which is we started as kids watching the show, and then we're asked as adults, we continue to engage with the show. And so that's why I think that makes her the most audience surrogate, and that's what I think contributes a lot to the success of this episode. But CC, I want to hear your opinion.
Yeah, I will disagree slightly. I definitely think this is a very good episode and a great introduction to like a new era of the show. But for me, the best post-regeneration story is still going to be Rose. Just because I feel like Rose is kind of the superior like audience surrogate character, because she has to be won over by the Doctor. You know, the Doctor kind of has to like pursue her and like engage her in traveling with him. Whereas from the get-go, Amy is like so obsessed with the Doctor, especially once we see her as an adult. She kind of like, I don't know how to describe it, like represents the like what a showrunner wants a fan to be, like someone who's just like instantly in love with Matt Smith, in love with the Doctor, wants right. to go and is going to drop all of her life at a moment's notice. I feel like Rose, the episode, had more like heavy lifting to do. But this is certainly like a really good episode and a really good like opening taste of what Moffat's going to bring for the entire rest of his run.
That's a fascinating point to make. I see what you mean, because it is like after that scene where she ties his tie to the car and he gives her the apple, her belief in him takes a huge backseat until the ending. She's just in it to win.
It becomes his. I don't know if it becomes his episode, but it just becomes like a standard episode, I think, after that point, until that final moment where you get the reveal of the wedding dress and the invite and stuff. Just back to Danny Houston briefly.
Of course, please.
Oh my, of course, yes, please go ahead. That's how it works here. We have a clock that's saying you have talked for Doctor Who for this much, and when we bank our time, we're like, and now we can talk about Danny Houston.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Pa Danny Houston Cast.
I just remembered him being on What the Fuck, Marc Maron, talking about like one of his he directed the film, and I've never heard someone be so clearly like pretending to care about someone's thing as Marc Maron was with that film that Danny Houston had directed. It was very awkward.
Has Marc Maron ever interviewed anyone from Doctor Who?
He probably has. I don't know.
Well, let's find out. You guys keep talking. I'm gonna search.
Something else that really got me in this is Arthur Darvill. I think is really good in this.
Arthur Darvill is so dialed in. It is actually, I've seen this episode so many times, and it still cooks for me, still works. But the thing I noticed this time was how much Arthur Darvill is like just in, and it actually makes me sad that it takes a while for him to become a companion, because I almost want to see him in the TARDIS by the end of the episode. I'm like, hey, I like his chemistry with Eleven. Can we put him in the TARDIS? And the fact that it takes so long, you know, there's a reason why, but also at the same time, I'm like, yeah, but also, I really like him. He's really fun.
Yeah. He's like a great response to the sort of energy like Mickey brought in those early episodes, because he still gets to be like doubtful of the Doctor, have a strong connection to Earth. He's trying to like drag his like companion back towards, but without being like a huge wet blanket or a downer. Like, he still, like, has fun as in and is engaged as a character while also trying to represent a certain, like, voice of reason.
Yeah. The stuff he does where he's like, did you just call them back? Did you just call the aliens back? It doesn't feel like, shut the fuck up. Like, it feels like an actual good, like, point to make and an interesting avenue to pursue for the episode to pursue. Although... It does avoid the Mickey problem, which I think, you know, when Mickey joins, immediately in the next episode, they're like, why are you here? Like, who asked you? It's like, you invited me. It's like, oh, cringe. You didn't get the hint. Get the fuck out. Like,
yeah, exactly.
He also has the most, like, 20... Well, I suppose it was 2009 in the film, but most 2010 phone of all time. It really brought me back to those days. That phone is like ancient. Oh, yeah.
The phone business in this episode is so interesting. It's such like a reflection of the time and parallel some like American TV from the time. You know, some of us are watching Fringe right now, of just like when cell phone companies were like throwing money at TV shows to be like, throw in a scene where someone uses like a 2G network to send an image, give you $1 million right. dollars to plug in the, you know, Nokia, whatever.
They're all on their phones. They're all on their phones.
It also reminds me that we're going to get so many more moments of Moffat going phones these days, which like far away in the, I see it coming in the distance, but it reminded me of that joke from 30 Rock where at one point Liz Lemon just goes like, yeah, like that phone with the 3G is so good. You know, if I saw that phone on television, I totally buy it. And then she just turns to the camera and goes like, can we have our money now? That's what it reminded me of. Although it did lead me to ask a question, so important question that did not leave my brain from the moment it happened in the episode until now. What the fuck is Bebo? He says, text it, email it, Facebook, Twitter it. Bebo.
You don't know what Bebo is.
What is Bebo?
I have no idea what Bebo is.
How am I the one who knows what Bebo is?
What is Bebo?
Bebo was... It was an American, first of all. American social network thing. Basically, it was just like... it was one of those kind of things. It was like, you know, it wasn't MySpace. It wasn't, you know, Facebook, whatever. It had its moment. It died in like, it didn't, it was around from like 2000. I'm looking at Wikipedia now. It was around from 2005 to 2013. So it was stolen. It was like on its last legs here.
That's impossible.
They brought it back.
I'm that Trump meme where he's like, I'm just hearing about this. Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I'm just amazing website.
They tried to bring it back in 2021, being like, you know, all the nostalgia for Bebo will be so high, and then it just never left. Like,
by the time this episode was on the air, it was already being sold off and being like shut down. This is like an episode of television in 2022 being like the great streaming websites, Netflix, Hulu, Quibi. Like, by then, you should have known this is not going to go anywhere.
Let me read you out what Bebo offered. A profile which had two specific modules. Basically, you had like a personal page where you could post blogs, photographs, music videos, and questionnaires. People could answer if they wanted to. You got like a profile which had a comment section for other users and a list of the users' friends. People could message you. There could be a profile in public and stuff. A video box could be added, either hotlinked from YouTube or copied from a Bebo Media content provider's page. Well, you had a thing called live stream, which this is where you get the idea that Bebo wasn't made to last. Livestream basically lets you link to other social media networks and then they post posts onto Bebo. So you know, Bebo, much like Danny Houston, kind of went away for a while. But Danny Houston's coming back now. Danny Houston is in The Crow.
David, shut the fuck up about Danny Houston. What are we saying? I'm sorry.
Okay.
Why is he coming back? Okay, tell me why he's coming back.
He's in The Crow. He's also in Horizon and American Saga. But to go back to another question you had, yes. The only person I could find who was on What the Fuck is Neil Patrick Harris.
What I thought.
Olivia Colman, I assumed, would maybe be on there at some point, but she hasn't been, which is kind of weird. But yeah. I don't know.
I really want to see Eccleston and Marin together. I bet that would be a wild conversation.
Oh my God. Right? I think that would be from your lips to God's ears. And by God, I mean Mark himself. Please get him. I mean, I think considering the publicity boost that's coming with the Disney money, I think we have like more than a 0% shot of Shuji being in WTF. Although, again, much like Daniel Day-Lewis, I do think if you told Mark Maron the words Doctor Who, like a sleeper agent, he would pull out a gun and shoot you, just like instinctively, and I'll remember he did
exactly.
it.
I mean, he always says, who are your guys? So he might just think you're saying, you know, one of my guys is my doctor. He might be like, well, that's the same with me. You know, that's
something. I think if you made that joke to him, he would stare at you. His eyes would turn into black holes and he would consume
his Marin leans into the mic and says, "Doctor Who are your guys?" And Eccleston shoots him with the gun.
Oh my God. Is there an email? Can we send him an email? Hold on. I got to find out if this has an email. Hold on. Contact. Here we go. Okay, email WTFpod@gmail.com. Here we go. I'm going to write this out live. Future guest. Hey, guys. Huge fan of the podcast here.
I promise you, I am not a crank. I am not a crazy person. You have to
put it on. Huge fan of the podcast here. Not a crazy person. Would it be possible for you guys to interview someone from the hit TV show? Doctor Who? And if so, would it also be possible for Mark to say, Doctor, who are your guys? Thank you so much. All my best, Michelle.
P.S. Can you please tell us if you actually like Danny Houston's directorial debut, The Last Photograph?
Can you actually tell us if you like Danny Houston? I really hope this hey, let's start the world's first ever Potter Who cast email campaign. Everybody, email WTF. Let's get one Doctor Who actor. I don't care who. Colin Baker, get him off his five plays he's doing all at once. Get him on WTF. I think we can do it.
I'm down. I think so.
What character have you played that you most identify with? That's a tough one, because I mainly play villains.
All of them.
I think something I want to talk about this episode, Prisoner Zero as a villain, kind of doesn't do anything. Mm-hmm. He just stares at people. Mm-hmm. His entire villainy is that he is on Earth. And as a result, Earth might die.
Mm-hmm.
Which it's such a weirdly, like, nothing villain. Right, like his villainy is more associated with things that other people do.
I mean, it's kind of interesting to have the Atraxi effectively be the major villains of the show, because they're the ones that are actually going to provide the danger. They're the ones going to blow up the planet. Do they take that idea far enough? Probably not. But it is interesting to have a little bit of, like, you know, the police are the real dangerous ones, you know, a glimmer of a narrative like that in, you know, a 2009 episode of Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm. Well, that it's kind of been there since the Jadoon.
Oh, true.
The Jadoon are very much like the space police, and they suck.
Mm-hmm.
But, go ahead, sorry.
Can I say something to you, and I want both of you to give me an honest answer. You are at work, okay? And you're supervising, you know, all this stuff. And this guy walks up to you and says, I have photographs of these people outside walking around. I can show them to you. If you just look at the phone, you see the photographs. Would you look at the phone, or would you be like, yeah,
I had the exact same thought where I'm like, just look at the phone. It'll take you 5 seconds and you will see it.
No, I would honestly be so offended that my underling would have an opinion in my face. No, I would throw that phone to the ground. I'd fire them. I'd walk away and hide in a broom closet and just sit very quietly until it's time for me to yell at an underling again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And hey, she dies. So she got what she was. If she had looked at the phone, she maybe would have survived, but she didn't.
That's true. Everyone, remember, look at your phones. It'll stop you from dying.
Mm-hmm. Always look at your phones.
Always look at your phone.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, always look at your laptops as well, especially when you have to hide your internet history, because that's obviously a joke that will never not be funny and hilarious and topical.
You say that, but I showed this episode a couple years back to my family, which consisted of my mom, who's 60-ish, and a younger family member who was like 16, and then another family member who was like also 60-ish. They all laughed at that joke. So there is something timeless about internet history jokes. Mm-hmm. Please keep making them.
Did they laugh when they realized the one foot in the grave trifecta was complete after Richard Wilson was in The Doctor Dances and Mrs. Warboys was in Eye of the Gorgon, Serve the Gorgon? And then Margaret was in this as Amy's elderly friend stroke grandmother figure slash neighbor slash just someone who's hanging around. Because to me, when I saw that happen, I was like, wow, you know, history has been made. This is just like when Danny Houston directed his award-winning...
I knew this was coming.
He actually won an award. He won an award for that film. I had to figure out what it was. I closed his Wikipedia page because I felt like I was being bullied for my love of Danny Houston.
I have nothing against Danny Houston. I have nothing against Danny Houston.
He didn't win. He got nominated for Best Film at the Edinburgh International Film Festival in 2017 for The Last Photograph. He lost.
Mm-hmm.
But he did win. He did win the Satellite Award for Best Supporting Actor for The Constant Gardener in 2005, which, you know, considering he wasn't nominated for an Oscar or anything, that was pretty good showing by him, actually. I don't know what you... Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. It's... Yeah. I
gotta see. On the topic of Prisoner of Zero, I think... Sorry, on the topic of Prisoner of Zero, I think that they have one good idea, which is the multi-form, and they use it really well.
Mm-hmm.
Although I wish we could have seen the dog speak with a human voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, always a bit.
That would have been a good bit. When Olivia Colman says, "I always have problem with the mouths," I want it to be like, is that a Wild Blue Yonder reference? Like, it does feel like this is a good idea. They do it twice. And then here's why that villain never came back, because who cares? You know, like, that's not the point of the villain. The point of the villain is he's somebody they need to chase, so that way they can then hand them over to the Atraxi.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Although I'm looking here, I'm looking at something in the TARDIS wiki that is giving me a chill down my spine. This is here that they appear on Day of the Moon. I do not recall this.
I don't either.
And it is getting me really scared. Because what does that mean? Is Richard Nixon a multi-form? Like, why were they on Day of the Moon?
I know what that is. I know what it is. They're in it in the sense that when that one silent on the ground, like, "We are the silence," there's like a flashback to them being like, "Silence will fall." Which, by the way, that whole thing, this is a bit that really annoys me, that whole thing just, it's so silly. When she's like, you know, "You don't know the cracks in the skin universe. Silence will fall. Pandora opens." It's just kind of annoying. What also is annoying is that Prisoner Zero has an action figure somehow.
They do?
Yeah. Do you want to
Slay.
See what, do you want to see what the base looks like? Because the base does not look very, very Slay to me. The base looks very much like something you can't bring to the playground because it looks very rude. I'm gonna send you a photo of Prisoner Zero's action figure. It's perfect. It looks like cum. Let's just be honest.
Wait, is your
cum okay?
This is what it looks like. If this comes out of your member, you need to go get checked. You, the people who watch Series 8 first, need to go get checked together.
And also the Danny Houston fans.
Need to go get checked.
I just looked at the, because I was intrigued by him winning this Allied Award for Best Supporting Actor in 2005. So I checked the Oscars, and that's the year you get George Clooney winning for Syriana. And also Paul Giamatti getting nominated. And Paul Giamatti.
I feel like Danny Houston is our perception filter, because he's always at the corner of our eye.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Are perception filters a new thing?
No, they're in.
He uses them a lot this season.
Last of the Time Lords, the key around their neck is a perception filter, and then John Sims like, "That wouldn't work on me. What the fuck are you thinking? How dare you? How dare you try and do that to me? I'm gonna kill you now." That's what Johnson, the actor, said before they even started rolling. He said, "How fucking dare you try and do that to me? I was in Life on Mars, you fucking assholes.
But the resurgence of the perception filter over the season, I think it speaks to a lot of what is the main thing this episode is trying to convey, which is the idea that this era of Doctor Who, the guiding theme is fairy tales. They get mentioned here because she starts going by Amy because Amelia was a little bit too fairy tale. The Doctor is portrayed as a fairy tale imaginary friend character, with like a name and a cut, like the Raggedy Doctor, and oh, you made toys of him and all that stuff. And the perception filter plays into that because, and also the crack, because they're both ideas that are like, you know, commonplace things that at some point you were told to like, oh, this is nothing. Like the crack in the wall is just a crack. And also if something's at the corner of your eye, just ignore it. But when you're a kid, you know, you're always like kind of looking around, things fascinate you. And, and those two things really add to the fairy tale aspect of this season.
Yeah, it's interesting that I feel from this point out, the Doctor is like known in universe as like a mega celebrity. Like this is really the time where they like treat the Doctor as always having a reputation that like precedes him. And I really think it as an element of like Moffat's storytelling, that he's like really interested in the Doctor as being this like hyper famous, hyper known, like center of myth sort of figure.
This is a thing that he's been doing since The Empty Child, which has that little exchange when, you got this gun from the factory? I've been there once. And then Jack Harkness goes, yeah, that factory blew up. And the Doctor goes, like I said, once. This is a thing Moffat loves to do. And I have to say, I mean, no diss against the guy. It is one of the things I'm most eager for Doctor Who to leave behind, because when everyone knows who the Doctor is, it just sort of makes things so repetitive. Everyone goes, the Doctor, or he goes, Murray, please play my theme, and you just hear
bum, 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 bum,
that theme. That theme has become associated in my mind with a specific kind of story, which is or a moment in a story, specific plot beat, which is the Doctor needs to tell you about how awesome he is, and that's what that theme has become.
Yeah,
because every time Eleven goes like, "I'm going to tell you how cool I am," that they just go ba 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 ba. But I will say that the Doctor is a mega celebrity. Has been. It's a Davies thing. It's a Davies thing, and Moffat just really blew it up to proportion. And I think it's interesting that it is one of the very few things that I will say that Chibnall took away that I think is actively good for the future of the show. Because I have very few memories of people looking at 13 and going, the Doctor, you know? And I think that's great, because when everyone knows who your character is, it sort of makes it so that the Doctor always has to act a certain way. Which we're going to talk about in a future episode, right? Which is the Doctor no longer plays the role of the impartial arbiter. What you're describing, CC, is kind of setting up what I think is the guiding role of the Doctor in the Moffat era, which is the caretaker of the universe. The person who decides who lives and dies and all that. Which is maybe the thing I like the least about the Moffat era, because it makes him feel less like a person who just decided to do good one day and is wandering across the universe. And turns him into like this mythical figure, which again, Davis started. There's literally a series 3 finale that's all about this. That's what the whole series 3 finale is about. But I think Moffat really blew it up so big and made it such an important part of the character that we're just barely getting away from it nowadays.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, as well, I think the finale is kind of like the whole, like, and we'll get the line, like, 10 weeks. The whole thing, the finale, like the whole crux is that like he got too powerful. Everyone like who hates him got together and said we have to stop him before his swag gets too mighty, before he gets too in the zone.
It does feel to me like after this point, whenever a recurring villain is the Doctor, they should stop going, oh, this guy again. They should go, we knew you were coming because you always show up. Mm-hmm. Right? It used to feel to me like the reaction the villains had to the Doctor was like, this fucking guy, oh my God, I swear to God, we have 500 plans and this is the one this guy doesn't show up. And now mm-hmm. it should be like everyone should have a Doctor contingency plan because he's always like, why are you not expecting him?
Mm-hmm.
And then, and of course, I feel like they try to course correct it with that thing in series six, which we'll talk about when we get to that, where he's like, I've become too big, I should lie down for a little bit, but they don't really course correct it. In fact, Capaldi comes back with it, and I think Capaldi suffers more under that than Smith does. Mm-hmm. Because with Smith, at least there's the contrast of, there's this image of who the Doctor is, and he's so young, and he's the youngest one, and he's like the most childish one. With Capaldi, that kind of goes away. But we're talking about something that's going to happen in 2 years for our audience.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that there's two masters in this?
I will let you go down this avenue, yeah. But I swear to God, if Danny Houston is at the end of this road,
he's not.
Okay. All right, go on.
Danny's gone home for a second. There's the one which is the whole joke. Well, it wasn't a joke at the time. The whole fan theory that because the prop department gave Arthur Darvill a ID badge that doesn't have like a proper date on it, that it was actually a secret ruse and he was the master of the entire time. There's that. There's also Patrick Moore, who is famous for playing the Game Master on the hit British TV show Game Master, which was basically like kids playing video games on TV.
Is Patrick Moore. Is that his deal? Is that why he's in this episode? Because no, he's a game show host?
No, he's an astronomer, but they got him to play the Games Master. I'll send you a picture of what the Games Master looks like. I'll explain this. But this is what Patrick Moore looked like in Games Master.
Oh, Jesus.
Is that
a screenshot from Rise of the Cybermen?
It's a screenshot of Games Master.
He's a Mordok type.
Mm-hmm. He's a Mordok. Can I share something about Patrick Moore that I just found out? I Googled mm-hmm. Patrick Moore Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. I'm going to read this quote for him. The trouble is, the BBC now is run by women, and it shows soap operas, cooking, quizzes, kitchen sink plays. You wouldn't have had that in the golden days. I would like to see two independent wavelengths, one controlled by women and one for us, controlled by men. I used to watch Doctor Who and Star Trek, but they went PC, making women commanders, that kind of thing. I stopped watching. I want you to guess when he said this.
He died
on his deathbed in like 2012, 2013.
He died like 2 years ago, I'm pretty sure. He didn't die like that like long ago.
He died in 2012.
Yeah. I'm wrong. I think he said that in 2011.
He said that in 2007.
Wow.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Can I read you a quote?
Yes.
sorry. Also, in my acting, I feel very much like a storyteller, exploring the flaws of the characters that I interpret. That's from Danny Houston.
God damn it, David.
Wow, what insightful advice. That's amazing.
Wrap it. You know what? I think I know exactly how to wrap this up. I'm gonna Google Danny Houston Doctor Who. Let's see if
someone shows up. The top result is from or/American Horror Story saying, is no one going to acknowledge Danny Houston in brackets Axeman returning? I'm gonna choose to interpret as his nickname being Axeman. That he likes to be called X-Men rather than being a character called X-Men. X-Men.
I will say Google gave me three pictures. One of them is of Danny Houston wearing sunglasses. One of them is of Aang from Avatar The Last Airbender, the finale.
Yeah,
his and the famous third one is of an unidentified anime boy with a sword.
They're his famous characters he played. He played Aang.
I'm not joking. Yeah. I said that's sort of, look at it. What is going on?
Famous characters. He famously played those characters on TV for 15 years.
That's where I know him from, of course. All right. I think that is It would be really funny if we say, I will never talk about Danny Houston again, and said, introducing the master as played by Danny Houston.
Exactly.
The new doctor, Danny Houston.
Danny Houston in that photo with the sunglasses has very much got 12 energy. So, you know.
He would be our 12 in our American Diary. We got to redo that episode and put him in it.
Mm-hmm. He's playing everyone, and he's going to be on the episode as well. I guess that's it. CC, do you have anything to plug that is or isn't related to Danny Houston?
Oh man, I started walking Danny Houston's dog recently, so that's pretty big news for me. No. You can find anything I'm up to at ccmclaughlin.com, which will have links to whatever social media platform exists at the time that you are listening to this episode. Other than that, I do hear the dog barking, so I should probably go take care of him. The dog's name is Doggy Houston.
Is it if I will let you go. I will let you go.
I want to plug something, which is you can go onto, as he proved, the WTF contact page and tell him to give love to Danny for his role in the last photograph, and to also get get Patrick Moore's, like, get an AI of Patrick Moore to go on there as well. You can talk about whatever he wants to talk about.
We did just get the AI. Did you guys see this? That they just announced the AI of Marilyn Monroe who you can talk to.
Yeah,
and because when I was watching, you know, some like how I was like, I sure wish I could ask what Marilyn Monroe thinks of woke. Like, that is exactly what I miss about her.
You can also get my Danny Houston AI. It's called DII.
Stop talking about Danny Houston. Well, I am actually getting mad about this man who did nothing wrong.
I don't know. That's probably it. Tip your local, I don't know, Danny Houston. I don't know. And
see you next time for what they call Danny Houston in bed, the Beast Below.
You don't know him like I know. Bye.
Next time on Pod Tour, Who Cast?
We should never have come here.
The darkness in the heart of this nation. Help us, Doctor.
The smiling fellas in the booze, they're everywhere.
Our only hope.
This isn't a trick, this is for real. You've got to find the Doctor and get him back to the TARDIS. Please get the Doctor.